computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we're speaking to author, researcher, James Norwood. Hello, Mr. Norwood.
Hello, Len. It's great to be on. Thank you.
Thank you very much for making time today. It came to my attention that you had a couple of articles written at harveyandlee.net, and also there's two at Kennedy's and King for people, you know, studying the JFK assassination research. They'll be familiar with you, but I'll probably just get you to give us a brief introduction to what got you interested in the case. Then we're going to read your latest article for people who haven't read it and, written by the author. And then we'll discuss the topic. But I'm so glad that you have made time for me today.
Well, thank you. This topic that we're on tonight derives from an article with the title, What's in a Name? Harvey and Lee and Why It Matters. And it's very much an introductory type article, but it's a fascinating story about the documentary evidence that lists Oswald's name both as Lee and as Harvey. It is also about the eyewitness testimony from people who knew one Oswald who answered to the name of Lee and one to the name of Harvey. Ruth Payne, whom all of your listeners know as one of the long-standing supporters of the Warren Commission, is without a doubt an important eyewitness in this case. She was questioned at greater length than any other eyewitness by the Warren Commission. And in one of her answers, there is a subtle reference suggesting that she thought of Oswald as Harvey, not Lee. You have to read the testimony very carefully, but at one point she works in the name Harvey. Of course, she's been a controversial eyewitness, but she made a major slip in her testimony when she identified Oswald, the Oswald she knew, as Harvey. There's another researcher of the JFK assassination named Steve Thomas, who has compiled a list of nearly 50 instances in government documents where Oswald's name is listed as Harvey Lee Oswald. His list and the sources appear on the website harveyandlee.net. This magnificent website includes detailed articles on all of the points that we're going to touch on in the presentation I'm giving this evening. Over many years, two boys using the same name and living in different families were participants in American intelligence operations. It is likely that references to them in government records include separate identifications. One boy was Lee Harvey Oswald, born to Marguerite Claverie Oswald on October 18th, 1939. The other boy was Harvey Lee Oswald, who was likely a Russian-speaking refugee from World War II, brought to this country with thousands of other refugees. Frank Wisner, was a Wall Street lawyer, and during World War II, he worked for the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the CIA. After the war, thousands of Eastern European refugees were brought to the United States under his supervision. National Security Council records show that Wisner, the CIA's director of clandestine operations by that time, oversaw the relocation of thousands of anti-communist exiles to the United States. Wisner became the CIA and State Department's expert on European war refugees, and he secretly subsidized relief organizations that brought these Eastern Bloc refugees to the United States throughout the 1940s and early 1950s. Wisner recognized that he could use these Eastern European immigrants' knowledge, customs, and familiarity with their respective homelands in the struggle against communism in the Cold War. Wisner asked the National Security Council to sanction the systematic use of such refugees, and they agreed. The NSC soon issued a top secret intelligence directive, NSCID number 14, which has been partially declassified. It tells us that on multiple occasions, the uses of the, quote, exploitation of aliens was taking place. That was exactly Wisner's goal in his massive project with the immigrants. These were not merely thousands of people, but likely tens of thousands of individuals who were given assignments involved in a quid pro quo arrangement. In return for the promise of citizenship, the immigrants would be required to perform tasks utilizing their knowledge and experience as Eastern Europeans. Often the work involved was simply being an informant on fellow Americans. But those immigrants who were exceptionally gifted with multilingual skills were often sent on assignments back to their homeland in Eastern Europe. In the context of the Cold War, it is important to remember that those Eastern European nations were receiving no benefits from the Marshall Plan. Their countries were now satellite states of the Soviet Union, and there was even fighting that continued in the Baltic nations long after the end of World War II. For Wisner, the displaced immigrants could be of use in the struggle against communism behind the Iron Curtain. With the authorization stipulated in the NSCID memo, the FBI and the CIA were able to jointly exploit the talents of over 200,000 Eastern European refugees resettled in the United States. The CIA soon contracted the Displaced Persons Commission, which worked closely with the leaders of refugee organizations in the United States. The DPC chairman, Ugo Carusi, sent a memorandum to all refugee organizations in the United States that read, "We would like to advise that the U.S. Commission, namely the Displaced Persons Commission, has a formal agreement with the CIA to cooperate in every possible way to facilitate their programs. It is therefore altogether desirable that local representatives of the voluntary agencies and state commissions and committees make available to fully identified CIA agents the addresses of displaced persons." In one of those projects, a young Russian-speaking refugee was selected and given the name Harvey Lee Oswald, and his birth date was often listed as October 19th, 1939, whereas October 18th was the birth date for the American-born Lee Harvey Oswald. It is of paramount importance to understand that the original purpose of the merging of two identities of these boys has nothing to do with the assassination of President Kennedy, whose political career as a congressman was just beginning at the time Wisner was recruiting the Eastern European refugees. The fledgling Oswald operation was one of thousands conducted by Wisner with the overarching goal of winning the Cold War. For this project, the idea was to place a Russian-speaking young man with the identity of an American citizen in the Soviet Union as a spy. During his stay, he concealed his knowledge of the Russian language while listening to and observing his hosts. His successful concealment of his Russian language proficiency while living in Minsk is covered in detail in the article Oswald's Proficiency in the Russian Language on the harveyandlee.net website. Two defining periods are at the heart of understanding the life story of the immigrant boy, Harvey Oswald. First, it was the carefully planned intelligence operation of merging his life with the American-born Lee Oswald between the late 1940s and the 1959 defection to the Soviet Union. Second, the period of August to November 1963 is pivotal after Harvey Oswald had returned from the Soviet Union and was now being groomed by the CIA as the patsy in the assassination of President Kennedy. It is likely that different CIA personnel were framing Oswald than those who originally conceived the Oswald Project as part of Frank Wisner's refugee program. In 1958, Wisner himself was diagnosed with manic depression and went into steep decline, retiring from the CIA in 1962 and dying by suicide in 1965. Still, the entire life of this young immigrant was overseen by the CIA, first in the role of a patriot when he defected to the Soviet Union, and later in the role, unwittingly, of the patsy in the death of President Kennedy. In the immediate aftermath of the assassination, there was a scramble to understand the background of the suspect who had been killed in the custody of the Dallas police. At the same time, there was a massive effort on the part of the FBI to suppress information about the Oswald Project. But much evidence slipped beneath the cracks, including a surviving teletype from December 4th, 1963, that was sent by an aide to Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. The aide was William J. Vandenhoevel, who was also the president of the International Rescue Committee. The teletype was intended to alert the FBI that there were files in possession of the International Rescue Committee that contained information pertaining to Oswald. There would have been no reason why the American-born Lee Oswald would have been of interest to the IRC, but it was entirely appropriate that the Russian-speaking immigrant Harvey Oswald would be identified by this organization if he were an immigrant from Eastern Europe recruited by American intelligence. Another piece of tantalizing evidence is the subject of an anonymous phone conversation to Mrs. Jack Tippett of Westport, Connecticut, on the day following the assassination. Mrs. Tippett's husband, a self-employed cartoonist for national magazines, was a distant relative of Officer J.D. Tippett, who was shot to death in Dallas on the afternoon of November 22nd. The anonymous caller indicated that she personally knew Oswald's father and uncle in New York City, who were from Hungary, promoted communism, and resided at 77th and 2nd Avenue in Yorkville. On multiple occasions during the call, the woman on the line indicated that she feared for her life in revealing this information. The text of a long-suppressed November 30th FBI teletype describing the phone call, as well as John Armstrong's analysis of the call, may be read in the article, Who Was Harvey?, on the harveyandlee.net website. The surviving evidence points to the unidentified refugee who was given the name Harvey Oswald as being placed with a caretaker who was given the name Margaret as opposed to Marguerite Oswald. The similarity in the names of Harvey Oswald and Margaret Oswald was of crucial importance administratively to distinguish the young immigrant and his caretaker mother from the real Marguerite Clavery Oswald and her young son, Lee. At the height of the McCarthy era, a House Un-American Activities Committee file in New York City made reference to a Mrs. M. Oswald in a CIA Office of Security file. The date on the file in 1953 would have coincided with the early phase of the Oswald Project. During the deliberations of the Assassination Records Review Board in the 1990s, Judge John Thunheim wrote to Congressman Henry Hyde and requested the HUAC file on Mrs. M. Oswald. Despite the fact that the JFK Records Act mandated the release of the documents, the request was denied to the ARRB. It is conceivable that this file may be among the records still being withheld from American public by the CIA. If released, it could potentially expose more completely the early stage of the Oswald Project. Both Harvey and Lee enlisted in the Marines, where they served separately between 1956 and 1959. The Marine enlistment card for Harvey Oswald, dated October 24, 1956, was recently discovered and was published for the first time on the harveyandlee.net website. The name that first appeared on the card was Harvey Lee Oswald. It was subsequently scratched off and re-entered as Lee Harvey Oswald. The card also indicates that both of the parents of the recruit are deceased. Yet it also identifies Marguerite Oswald as the recruit's mother, still living. It also indicates that the parents were not divorced, but the real Marguerite Oswald was divorced on two occasions and was living at the time at a different location than the address indicated on the card. If there had only been one Lee Harvey Oswald, there never would have been the set of anomalies evident on the enlistment card. Shortly after Harvey Oswald enrolled in the Marines, he was sent to San Diego for boot camp. But at the same time, Lee Oswald was receiving his training at the Marine Corps Air Facility in El Toro, up the California coast near Irvine in Orange County. Images of the two-sided enlistment card of Harvey Oswald, along with detailed analysis, appear in the article Marine Corps and the Soviet Union on the harveyandlee.net website. An especially important period that clearly confused the Warren Commission staff was from October 1957 through spring 1958. At that time, Lee Oswald was on active duty in the Marines, and his presence in Japan is documented in Marine records. But at the same time, Harvey Oswald was residing in New Orleans, as apparent in the testimony of Harvey's friend Palmer McBride and employment records of the Pfister Dental Lab in New Orleans. In early October, Harvey and Palmer attended a rare production of the opera Boris Godunov in New Orleans. But a month earlier, Lee had arrived in Atsugi, Japan, aboard the USS Bexar on September 12th. This period is covered in detail on the Harvey and Lee website with both Oswald's work records and testimony from members of an astronomy club that place Harvey Oswald in New Orleans at the time when Lee was in Japan. The final assignment for Harvey Oswald during his stint in the Marines was for him to be stationed at the 9th Marine Air Control Station, MACS-9, in Santa Ana, California. Around the same time, Lee Oswald was once again assigned to the nearby El Toro Marine Corps Air Facility. The Warren Commission failed to identify the two distinct bases, which were approximately 10 miles apart in Orange County. In 1959, Major William P. Gorski was Assistant Provost Marshal at the Marine Corps Air Station at El Toro. Gorski's files show that Lee Oswald was discharged from the Marine base in March 1959, but Harvey, stationed in nearby Santa Ana, was not discharged until the following September. The Warren Commission selectively focused on interviewing Marines in the smaller MACS-9 base for firsthand accounts about Harvey Oswald when he was preparing for his defection to the Soviet Union and was all but advertising his love of Russian culture and fascination with Marxist ideology. For his fellow Marines, he was putting on quite a show in playing recordings of Tchaikovsky's Russian War Dance, reading Russian language newspapers, addressing his buddies as comrade, and asking his roommate, James Botello, to call him Oswaldovich. When he applied for a dependency discharge to help his allegedly injured mother, the accompanying parents' affidavit form lists the same Marine ID number, 165-3230, that corresponds to the number on his original enlistment card. But in the box entitled, "My Children Currently Serving in the Armed Forces," the applicant lists her son name as Harvey Lee Oswald, who was currently stationed at the MACS-9 base. Was this a slip on the part of Margaret Oswald, who habitually referred to her son as Harvey? Or was it a conscious choice in bookkeeping in order to distinguish Harvey Oswald from the other Marine, Lee Oswald, who had been discharged the previous March? It is clear that this was much more than a mere clerical error, due to the pattern of references to Harvey Lee Oswald that show up time and time again in the documentary record. Specialists in linguistics have also weighed in on the writing and speaking patterns of Harvey Oswald. In December 1963, Vladimir Petrov, head of the Slavic Language Department at Yale University, read a copy of a letter Oswald had written to Senator John Tower. Petrov stated that, "I am satisfied that the letter was not written by him. It was written by a Russian with an imperfect knowledge of English." In an unrelated study, several professors at Southern Methodist University listened to the voice of Oswald from the 1963 New Orleans radio interview without being told that it was Oswald speaking. The experts concluded that the man was not a native-born American. Rather, he was speaking English as a second language. The New Orleans-born Lee Harvey Oswald preferred to be addressed as Lee, while the young Eastern European immigrant identified himself as Harvey. As early as 1953 through 1954, there are four witnesses in three different locations that identified one of the boys as Harvey Oswald. Psychiatrist Dr. Milton Currian interviewed Harvey Lee Oswald in New York in March 1953. William Henry Timmer met Harvey Oswald in Stanley, North Dakota in the summer of 1953. And when Oswald entered Myra DeRusse's homeroom class in New Orleans in early 1954, he asked his teacher to call him Harvey. Harvey's best friend in the spring semester of the eighth grade at Beauregard Junior High in New Orleans was Ed Vogel, who knew the young Oswald as Harvey. In each instance of a reference to Harvey Lee Oswald in the documentary record, there is a story behind the name Harvey, which precedes Lee. One very important reference is found on the typewritten sheet of employees of the Texas School Book Depository prepared by Lieutenant Jack Revel, intelligence officer of the Dallas police on the day of the assassination. Revel, however, was not typing from records provided to him by the TSBD. Instead, he had in all probability received information about Oswald from an officer of Naval Intelligence with whom he rode back to the station after a short trip to Dealey Plaza. The name appearing at the head of Revel's list is Harvey Lee Oswald. Additionally, Oswald's address of 605 Elspeth in Dallas is inaccurate. The correct location was 602 Elspeth. That address was not found in any records of the TSBD. In an unrelated document discovered in the 1980s, a file from the 112th Military Intelligence Group listed a man named Harvey Lee Oswald, who was a pro-communist who had been in Russia and had been involved in pro-Castro activities in New Orleans. That document also listed the man's name as Harvey Lee Oswald with the same incorrect address of 605 Elspeth. Taken together, the two documents identifying Harvey Lee Oswald residing at an incorrect address point to the intelligence network implicating Oswald in the assassination of President Kennedy almost instantly after the shooting. Researcher Jim Mars offers a detailed overview of the multifaceted circumstances of an immediate identification of Harvey Oswald as the suspect in video number 23 from Len Osanek's outstanding series, 50 Reasons for 50 Years. As researcher Peter Dale Scott observes, the usage of the name Harvey Lee Oswald is no accidental anomaly, but part of an organized pattern, widely dispersed, that suggests an official intelligence deception and possible dual filing system, a consistent pattern of behavior in these agencies since the assassination, has been the tendency to suppress references to Harvey Lee Oswald and replace them by the more standard Lee Harvey Oswald. The suppression of references to Harvey Oswald was the exact function of the FBI and the Warren Commission, which were both instrumental in concealing the identity of the two Oswalds. The backgrounds of the two young men were combined into a single biographical profile, that manufactured biography of a composite of two men, was the centerpiece of the Warren Report, published on September 24, 1964. The man who was accused of killing JFK was not American-born Lee Harvey Oswald, but was an unknown refugee brought to this country as a child. Due to his fluency in the Russian language, he was monitored, directed, and trained during his formative years for the express purpose of defecting to the Soviet Union while working for the CIA. At a later time, this man, who had served his new country in the area of espionage, was targeted by his handlers to be the scapegoat in the assassination of President Kennedy. For nearly his entire life, the experience of the immigrant Harvey Oswald was circumscribed by the CIA. The government's staunch reluctance to release documentary evidence in the assassination of President Kennedy is almost certainly tied to the cover-up of the existence of the two Oswalds that has been suppressed from the American public for nearly 60 years. Now, Len, we've only really scratched the surface on so many important topics here, but all of the main points in this presentation are covered in great detail in John Armstrong's articles on the website designed by Jim Hargrove. And I think it's important to mention as well that John Armstrong did the bulk of his research in the 1990s. That decade was especially important because it was a climate that was much more open following the release of Oliver Stone's film, JFK. So eyewitnesses were certainly prone now to be more forthcoming about what they knew about Oswald. And John Armstrong has even videotaped a number of these interviews with key eyewitnesses who are, for the most part, all now deceased.
Yeah, and there wasn't, I mean, I think with the Soviet Union collapsing, they thought, well, what, I don't have anything to lose now if somebody wants to speak out about it.
Yes, the time was just right for those people coming forward. And I think that for anyone who wants to get engaged in this topic, it's important to keep in mind that it takes time to absorb all of the details and see how the documentary evidence intersects with eyewitness testimony.
Yeah, you know, it's a real shock to the system when you first get into John Armstrong's research because it flips the world upside down. At least if you were doubting, you didn't believe the Warren Commission, you thought something was up. But then this is so dark, you have to really get into the mind control, the MK Ultra areas, and then double spies, and just what was going on at that Cold War. You know, how far would they go, right? I mean, would they really be planning this? And then when you come to the, if you come to that conclusion that there's an imposter, there's somebody else, there's two people with the name, and they're planning long term here, The Soviets were hip to that, and they got Marina Oswald to come to America. This is the perfect setup, because once they blame Lee Oswald for the murder, the Russians, the Soviets, they couldn't say a word. They said, well, you know, our double agent, our spy Marina, is there married to him. Like, the shit's going to hit the fan here.
Yes, I think it's so important to understand the workings of the CIA during the Cold War. I've written a book that's entitled Former People, and it's a macro study of the assassination, and I'm sure many listeners will be familiar with a lot of the basic background, but I wanted to try to prepare a book that would try to reduce the shock value a little bit, as you were describing, and the idea of getting kind of in touch with the workings of the Cold War is essential, especially when we learn about this plan for the immigration and how many people were basically exploited in the name of national security. Of course, immigration is a controversial issue today, but it's shocking to think that hundreds of thousands of people came to this country, but there was a sort of a deal involved. We're going to let you come here, and we're going to let you become citizens, but you've got to, in return, give us something. And so the idea of training and then planting a spy who is proficient in the Russian language is something that is not out of the ordinary when compared with some of these other really extreme CIA projects of the era.
Well, if one of those projects were sending, quote, phony defectors, you know, what would one say if he said, listen, there was a couple of people that went before Lee, and there's one guy named Robert Webster. Yes. Would you be surprised to hear that Marina dated him?
Yes, exactly. And there were just so few of those defections, so-called, that it's hard to even find a single person who really genuinely wanted to live and commit to the communism of the USSR at this time.
And then I think when you get into the U.S. Military Defense Department, it's kind of like there isn't anything they wouldn't do, that this fear, Pavlovian fear of the Soviet Union, that all bets were off. Anything was fair game in this case.
Yes, absolutely. Another point that I'd like to raise to listeners is the importance of understanding Oswald's Russian language proficiency. And there's actually been very little written on this subject. My article on the Harvey and Lee website gets into it in detail. But in my book, Former People, I left that to the very end of the book because I know it's just a lot to take in. But the evidence is simply overwhelming that even before Oswald left for the Soviet Union in 1959, he was already fluent in the Russian language. And so the question is, how did he learn this very difficult language? And I've never seen any convincing explanation that he taught Russian himself, learned it on his own, that he was involved in the Monterey School of Language school for training, in a crash course for Russian. We know that he didn't learn it while he was in Minsk, because throughout his stay there for 2.5 years, he essentially was not speaking Russian. He was concealing from his hosts his ability to speak Russian. And that was documented especially well in Norman Mailer's book, where Mailer was really one of the first to have access to a number of the Soviet files after the end of the Cold War. And so if one can understand how Oswald knew the Russian language, it's one step in the puzzle to understanding his identity, why he was recruited, and then on the other end, why he was the perfect patsy in 1962, because the perfect legend has already been crafted for him that he was a Slavophile, he was sympathetic to Castro, he lived in the Soviet Union. And of course, those were some of the very first things reported when he was taken into custody on November 22nd.
Yeah, you know, the fact that there's a story about him, a background, you find out that military intelligence in Dallas already had background on him, and somebody's leaking information to the police there. Oh, you should look here. Here's the name, you know. You know, the thing is, at arm's length, people say, I've heard enough information that I recognize that there was an imposter. Somebody was either ordering guns or at a car lot or at rifle range, or, you know, there's something going on. And then right there you can say, okay, some kind of intelligence operation's going on here. And just how dark is it, you know? And I think it's John Armstrong's work has gone, you know, further than anyone. And it takes, you know, people like me, even with making the episode for 50 Reasons back in 2013, I mean, you kind of go, are you sure about this? Are you right? And John Armstrong has all these documents and that. It's up to someone to work that conclusion out to them. And it's another level.
I think what's so important to recognize, Len, because you make very good points, that how many new books do we regularly get about Oswald? How many researchers have said, well, there's not much been published on him. Why don't I research him like John Wilkes Booth, where surely there's going to be some new information. But nobody will touch this subject. There was one BBC reporter that on the 50th anniversary decided to go to Minsk and interview the people who had known Oswald and worked in the factory with him in Minsk. And he was hoping that he would come up with a treasure trove of evidence to show just how evil this person was. But it was a great surprise to him that to a person, everyone he interviewed thought that this young man was incapable of killing the president or incapable of killing anyone based on their experience of him.
And that's people that worked with them, knew him, went out with him for coffee or whatever, right? You know, so there you go. And then the further you get into the Warren Commission, as they're painting a picture of this, you know, like you hear Dan Rather and these other guys saying, oh, he wanted to make his mark in history or be famous or something, right? You know, and it's quite eye-opening. It's just, you go, would they lie to that degree? And then you go, they're just outright lying. They're lying, you know.
And, of course, they always go back to that one main point, that he was a malcontent, a loser. He wanted to make his mark on history. In one of the rare books that actually has been published recently, the book by Paul Gregory that's written in the form of a memoir, Gregory says that when he knew Oswald, he gave no sign at all of having the potential to be an assassin. But then he turns around and just cites the Warren Report for support. I think, too, that, you know, there's so much discussion about the final documents that still have not been released about the JFK case and why they are still being withheld. And I have to think it's almost certain that some of those documents are going to reveal the connections of Oswald to the intelligence network and how he was groomed, perhaps in this long-standing project as a spy, that will completely deflate the Warren Commission findings.
Yeah, it's 100%. I mean, if you're despondent or something about looking into this case, then you have to come to the realization that the whole government is everything you thought they stood for, the Justice Department, Customs, anything, FBI, the military itself is complicit in this lie of removing a president that we thought was doing good for the world. And since the fact, you can kind of see how it's gone sideways or downhill. And then the blame on this guy. And the one quote that I believe is from Donald Trump talking to Judge Andrew Napolitano, where he said, I thought you were going to release documents, or you're going to release something. And he said, I'll tell you later when I'm not on the phone and there's not like 14 people listening. But if you saw what I saw, you'd realize why we can never release the documents. And I just believe that. I, of course, they did it. And I lean towards Alan Dulles. I lean towards all the people around him. He represented Sullivan Cromwell, the big law firm for all the big business of America. There will be banking interest money. I really think that the names that will come out are names that have never been mentioned. The people who help finance CIA assets and the big business assets of the Pentagon. Somebody that never gets spoken about, I'll just say, like Paul Helliwell. These guys that are in the banks in Jamaica and in the Bahamas and in Australia, the Nugan Hand Bank, where the guys, anyway, I don't have to get into that. But just, you know, the real people, we have not heard their names. And if these documents were to come out, those names would be on it. And they would say, oh, yeah, so forget about...
I, too, heard that Napolitano interview. And, you know, it's just so disrespectful to the American people to suggest, Well, we just can't reveal it because you couldn't handle it. And the fact of the matter is that in a republic, the people deserve to know the truth, whatever it is about their system. It's a government of the people, by the people, for the people. But it's interesting you raise that point because J. Edgar Hoover said the same thing. He told a friend who asked him, well, what do you think, did Oswald really do it? And Hoover replied, well, if I were to tell you what I really know, it would be a great disruption of our organized government.
Right. And you said republic. Most people are thinking it's a democracy, and that's almost laughable. And now, like in the latest things where the government meets and gives $80 billion or $60 billion to Israel and Ukraine and wars, and the rest of the people are saying, we're not voting for that. We don't want to do that. You know, tent cities everywhere. America is crumbling. What do you mean you've got money for every little skirmish around the world? We don't want that. And it's like, no. We're in charge here, and we have stocks in Raytheon and Boeing and all the arms industries. So we're making big kickbacks from keeping these things going. And meanwhile, an honest journalist like Julian Assange, who's reporting on these crimes, is in jail for crimes. You know, he's reporting on the war crimes. I think at the correspondence dinner the other day where Biden spoke, it's beyond a joke, a bad joke. They don't mention him at all. All they do is talk about, is it a great democracy? Yeah. I'm almost had enough.
That's why it's just so important that for something, we need to really hear the truth. And for the JFK case, it would be really nice to get some closure on it.
Yes, that. And then Bobby Kennedy. And then Martin Luther King. You know, it's an uphill battle, but thanks for doing your part. And, you know, like I say, if there was only one person writing, like John Armstrong, some people can write him off. He said, well, that's too crazy. It's too outlandish for me to be able to accept. You know, maybe there was an imposter, fine. But what do you mean there was a whole system of this? And then, like I earlier said, well, what if I told you there was four other defectors, false defectors? Well, what if it was part of a program? And then the fact that Marina had dated Robert Webster, was it? Yeah. You'd go, no, come on. Even if this is getting into science fiction, I can believe a few things, but not that, right?
Exactly. It would be nice if Marina would sort of come out of hiding and tell a little more about what she knows.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I don't know if this was ever publicly said, but I did talk to Jesse Ventura just about that, and he met with her privately, and he just said something to the effect that she has children still, and her number one aim is, like, you know, keeping them safe. So, you know, with the amount of people that have been bumped off or one car accidents or things like that, I think maybe she has been warned or only too aware that, you know, something will happen. I mean, yeah, Epstein, right? Suicided himself, and no cameras working, nothing. There's a reporter, Michael Hastings, right, reporting on a military general. His car blows up, right, after he told people he's got to hide. They're after him. I mean, just example after example, right? So
yeah, I do feel for Marina and her family.
You mentioned Ruth earlier. See, there's somebody that you could say, okay, come on, when are you going to admit? But she's not going to either.
Yes.
Ruth Payne.
It would be nice. I doubt if she's ever going to come clean.
I think when you're too far deep into the lie like that, you would have to say, well, my whole life has been a lie then if I come clean. And there's been a few people that have made, I'll leave that alone, but I just want to make sure that you had time. Thank you for reading this. And then you mentioned that you had five articles at Harvey and Lee. I didn't know there was that many there. I'll just get back to that because what was it about the dual identities or the two sets of documents that caught your interest to start looking into this matter?
Well, I was just always confused about the identity of Oswald because nothing made sense. And so, and it was really never the photographic evidence that interested me, but it was the conflicts in documentary and eyewitness testimony that just didn't match. And it's just a law of physics that you can't be two places at the same time. And so I think if there was any single point, it was that just too many instances where there are documented materials suggesting that these two young men, the two boys and the two young men, were in different places. I also wrote an article exclusively on the voice of Oswald. I'd mentioned a little earlier that a couple of linguists felt that he was speaking English with a second language. But there's even more evidence than that, in that he never, ever showed much of a Southern accent. And yet his brothers both spoke with Southern accents. And in one of the Warren Commission testimonies, his cousin told the Warren Commissioners that it was so interesting that I have this cousin whose accent is so unique. In other words, and she went on to say that he hits the ends of consonants so well at the ends of words. And why would a cousin be talking about that? And the evidence suggests that the real Lee Oswald spoke with a Southern accent. There are reports that he was mocked when he came up to New York because he spoke in Southern accent, and that he was a little disturbed because in his school, he was now in the classroom with African Americans. And yet then, the other boy, little Harvey, goes down to Louisiana, and he gets mocked because he's talking like a Yankee. And he's sitting in the back of the bus unaware that it's probably not a good idea to sit with the black people because he once stepped off the bus and a bunch of kids beat him up because he thought he was too friendly to the African Americans. So it's sort of the tip of the iceberg when we take a topic such as a really specialized topic like the voice of Oswald and really dissect that and see that the information adds up once again to the presence of two Oswalds, two boys with the same name.
Yeah, and then, you know, what interested me was the guy who said he saw, he took down a license plate of a guy sitting out by the gas station out behind there, and he said, look, if that wasn't Lee Oswald, it was his twin. Or if that wasn't Lee Oswald, that was his brother or something like that. So there was somebody that looked like him.
And then so many people have used that in almost the same exact words.
Yeah.
Like him being escorted out of the Texas theater, they used that. Roger Craig said that about the guy who came out of the Texas School Book Depository and got into the Rambler. That either had to be Oswald or was his twin brother.
And The Flight from Dallas, is it?
Yeah.
That book, written by the guy's lawyer friend. I forget his name now. But yeah, he was saying that was strange, right? And you know, days later when you're looking at the, you know, magazine and all that, he goes, that was the guy in the plane with me, you know, flying out on that military
yes.
plane from the river there.
Yes.
Goodness. Okay, well, this is so interesting. John Armstrong's, you know, I've met him many times over the years and talked to him, and it still is a little overwhelming for me, but, you know, I just keep, it's like mountain climbing. Okay, I'll get to the next base camp. Okay, I'm with you here. You know, I'm up a little further. So the fact is that even if I drag my feet on some of the conclusions, you just look at the documents and the statements and the information that he's dug up. And that's kind of what isn't going away. And it's You know, it's interesting studying this because I think for me, studying the JFK assassination is a little history lesson that you go, well, this is the way the world works. And it's true. Yeah, the J. Edgar Hoover hated him. You know, a lot of big business hated him. And finally, the CIA and their assets, they got rid of the guy. And, you know, when you're growing up, you wouldn't think that was going to happen. But, you know, it's just laid out here. And then the education is, well, did everybody cover it up? Did they lie about it? Yeah. Yeah. And you start to learn more than, you know, like whatever the Warren Commission and people are saying, it's just not true at all. Whether you want to believe there was one gunman or three or whatever, you know, it's just lie after lie, a real distrust of the government and every agency that's supposed to keep the semblance of democracy or a republic intact. It isn't at all.
Yes. And the book, Harvey and Lee, is so important because it includes the CD-ROM. And if, as you're reading, you punch in that CD-ROM, it includes a just enormous repository of documents. So you can see and read the documents right on the screen. It's a very essential and well-documented book for sure.
Yeah, I don't know how many are left. I think he must have made like 1,000 or something to start with, right? I've got one, though. Yeah, sure glad I bought it because it's sometimes you see them up for sale like for $400 or something, right? It's very rare now.
Well, I know it's back in print and available now on the harveyandlee.net website.
That's a plug that everybody should get one. Whether you're subscribed to every conclusion or not, you'll just lay out, here's what I found. You know, one side of the table, somebody's here. The other side of the table here. They're in New Orleans or they're in Mexico or they're, you know, in Dallas. Like, pick one, but they can't be at the same time, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. This is contribution. Okay, well, your article, What's in a Name? I'm going to make a link to that. Actually, the title is What's in a Name, Harvey and Lee, and Why It Matters.
Correct.
That's good that you still are with the implication it matters because we should understand this history for, if anything, to keep it from happening again.
Exactly. Well, Len, thank you so much for this time.
Good. Before we then wrap up, is there anything you wanted to bring up about anything else? I give you that opportunity now.
No, thank you so much.
Oh, all right then. Okay. Well, we'll keep in touch via email. And I'll have to go through some of these other articles that are there that you've written at harveyandlee.net. And Mr. Norwood, thank you for sharing time with me today.
Thank you very much, Len. Have a good night.
Okay, good night.
Bye.